What's next for El Chapo today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. Mexico begins the process of extraditing recaptured drug kingpin El Chapo to the U.S. That's a big deal following the embarrassment of his escape from prison 6 months ago.
It's also embarrassing that the Mexican government has to say the only way that we can keep control of this notorious drug lord is by sending him to another country.
Also, remembering what young Iranians made of David Bowie back in the early days of the revolution.
We could not find anything more different than the mullahs that were ruling Iran at that time than David Bowie.
Plus, global travelers arriving at airports in the U.S. with food often have it confiscated. So where does it all go?
Probably one of the largest garbage disposals in the world.
Those stories today on The World. I've been a David Bowie fan ever since the 70s, but it took his death to really bring home what an impact he had on people all over the globe for many reasons. Music, obviously, but it didn't stop there. We'll tell you more a bit later in the show. But we start today with news about the recapture of Mexican drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. Shorty had escaped from jail through a network of secret tunnels last summer. Then on Friday, we heard he had been nabbed again. An interview he gave to actor Sean Penn may or may not have helped Mexican police track him down. More on that in a moment. Meantime, Washington is trying to get El Chapo extradited so that he can stand trial here on a number of drugs charges. Sylvia Longmire is an analyst on drug trafficking and border violence. What is the latest on the extradition?
Well, from what we're hearing, Mexican government has agreed to the United States government's request to extradite El Chapo. However, they're saying that it could take as much as 6 months to a year in order for him to actually reach the United States.
Yeah, I was wondering that, does the Mexican government actually kind of see extradition to the U.S. as maybe a form of insurance to keep him from escaping again?
Absolutely. And of course, it's bad enough of an embarrassment that he escaped the last time that they were able to apprehend him. It's also embarrassing that the Mexican government has to say the only way that we can keep control of this notorious drug lord is by sending him to another country. They, of course, want to prevent any further humiliation by preventing him from escaping a third time. But yeah, that's really the only way that they can assure almost 100% that he's not going to escape again is by sending him north of the border.
Why does the United States want him, and what would be the charges?
It would be under several drug trafficking charges, and I haven't looked at the detailed list yet, but I'm sure that, you know, money laundering and a whole host of other charges is probably on the list for all those districts that have indicted him. The biggest benefit is his intelligence value, information they can provide to him about either members of his own cartel or members of rival cartels, operations, how the drugs are moved across the border, etc. And hopefully the United States government will be more willing to share that kind of intelligence information with the Mexican government in exchange for them agreeing to the extradition.
Would there be murder charges on the docket?
Unless El Chapo actually committed or ordered a murder in the United States, I'm not sure how that works. I'm sure there are murder charges against him in Mexico. But as far as how they will be indicting him, I believe it's only going to be on drug trafficking charges. If there are any homicide charges in there, part of the extradition agreement is that they cannot seek any capital punishment in the United States, and they also can't have any kind of imprisonment length for longer than a certain amount of time is how that treaty works.
Now, apparently, Guzman's lawyers are already challenging the request for extradition on grounds of defending national sovereignty. Do they have much chance of doing anything other than just slowing down the extradition process?
No, they really don't. I was reading today that there's really no chance that any of those appeals are going to be approved, and they haven't in past for kingpins that have been extradited and are now residing in federal prisons in the United States. But by buying that time, that gives his people enough of an opportunity to perhaps try to plan another escape, which is obviously the biggest concern.
Yeah. Now, the last time Guzman was arrested, the Mexican authorities said they'd only consider extradition after he served time in Mexico, like in 300 to 400 years.
Right, right.
What do you think accounts for this change of heart?
Definitely the escape. I think the escape had everything to do with it. And the fact that President Peña Nieto was so confident in his statement that we're going to be able to take care of this, we're going to be able to keep him in prison. When that didn't happen, there's no chance that the administration could survive another humiliation like that. So I think that's really the biggest factor.
So how soon could we see El Chapo being taken north to the United States, do you think?
I have to agree. When Mexico says that it's going to be at least 6 months to a year, you take a look at previous extradition attempts, most notably Edgar Labarbi Valdez Villarreal. He was arrested back in 2010, and he wasn't extradited until last year. I'm not saying that it's going to take 5 years for El Chapo, but Mexico likes to take its time. It's in their best interest to get him to the United States as quickly as possible, but things tend to move slowly in Mexico when the justice system is involved.
Author, analyst, and former Air Force Special Agent Sylvia Longmire. One of the more intriguing wrinkles in El Chapo's latest capture, the fact that he met with American actor Sean Penn in recent months. Penn's account was published over the weekend by Rolling Stone magazine. A Mexican actress named Kate Del Castillo reportedly helped arrange the meeting. The New York Times' Elizabeth Malkin is in Mexico City.
Kate Del Castillo worked many years in Mexico as an actress in telenovelas. Those are the famous weepy soap operas. But she became very famous sort of all over the Spanish-speaking world in a telenovela called La Reina del Sur. And it was the story, in fact, of a drug queenpin from the state of Sinaloa. It was based on a novel by a Spanish novelist.
Is that significant in some way to her connecting Sean Penn to El Chapo Guzman?
Well, it's hard to know what El Chapo Guzman's TV watching habits are. He got in touch with Kate Del Castillo through intermediaries after she wrote a note on Twitter to him. She addressed Chapo Guzman directly. It's hard to say if it's really a question of admiration. In the note, she said, wouldn't it be good if, you know, rather than trafficking in drugs, you trafficked for the good of people and you fed street children and you burned down brothels? You know, why don't you traffic in good, not drugs? And it was apparently, according to Sean Penn's story, after that, that through intermediaries, El Chapo got in touch with her. This connection continued when he was jailed in 2014, when the idea of making a movie emerged and he wanted her. So as we all know, El Chapo has had a number of wives and many other connections. So he was clearly quite taken with her.
Well, whether Ms. Castillo admires El Chapo or not, she did once famously say that she would trust El Chapo before the Mexican government. And I gather that's a feeling, that's a sentiment that's fairly widely held, or maybe surprisingly widely held. What does that all suggest?
Let's put it this way. If Mexicans don't trust the government, and many people do not, that doesn't mean that they trust El Chapo. It means that there is a certain fascination with the outlaw in Mexico, as in many other countries, and that El Chapo is seen as somebody who just continues until Friday to evade capture. And there's a certain admiration for that. I don't think we should be confused about how brutal, how violent he is, the damage that's been done in Mexico by cartels. I think we should never lose sight of that.
I mean, this idea that the actress, Ms. Del Castillo, pushed, the campaign of doing good, does somebody like El Chapo, was he feeding children?
You know, a lot of drug traffickers here are known to hand out favors, to give out money, to give out gifts, to do parties, to endow churches. I mean, they have that sort of presence. But the idea that they sort of constitute an alternative development program, I think that would be taking it a bit far.
It kind of sounds a bit like ISIS. They kill people, but they're also bringing some services to, shall we say, the people they oversee. Would you go so far as to say in Mexico that El Chapo is seen as a kind of Robin Hood, or it's not even that?
No. No, I think there may be people who admire him in his own state, and he's a mythical figure because of his escapes. But this is a country that's very weary of deaths. I think that if you went to Ciudad Juarez, which at one point was the most murderous city in the world, I don't think there'd be a lot of admiration there.
That was Elizabeth Malkin in Mexico City for the New York Times there. Sean Penn's interview with El Chapo and his article in Rolling Stone have annoyed journalists who normally cover Mexico and the drug war. Journalists like Alfredo Corchado, Mexico correspondent for the Dallas Morning News. Alfredo, you tweeted this to describe Chapo-Sean Penn meeting as an interview is an epic insult to journalists who died in the name of truth. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, at first, you know, I think like a lot of people, I was fascinated by the idea that the most sought-after interview, the man who we all wanted to talk to, had spoken. And then I read through it, and the more I thought about it, the memory of so many colleagues in Mexico, so many people who have died, you know, trying to search for truth, it just really rubbed me the wrong way. There was no accountability, journalism. I mean, we have to remember that in the last 10 years or so, more than 120,000 have been killed or disappeared. I mean, these are people throughout the country. More than 100 journalists have been killed. And, you know, there's no questions. And then I read about the conditions. You know, you had to send a story for pre-approval. There were no follow-up questions. There was no probing, no challenging. I mean, there were so many questions that I thought, you know, could have been answered. And what really bothered me the most was the idea that here we are trying to, a media publication, trying to just add to this man's myth and not really get to any kind of accountability. Who's ordering the killing? I mean, who's on the take? Names? Where's the corruption coming from? Et cetera. And I just thought it was a really wasted opportunity.
I know you've received death threats yourself, Alfredo. Is it possible that some of your colleagues' killings were ordered by El Chapo?
It's possible. I mean, that's one of the questions, you know, that I think a lot of us want to know. I mean, who ordered what and why? But certainly journalists in regions that the Sinaloa cartel controls have been killed, have vanished, disappeared, threatened. And again, no accountability, no protection from the government. No one really talks about it. I mean, 95% impunity rate in Mexico. That means that less than 5% of all cases are ever solved, if at all.
And typically, what are the reasons for journalists getting killed?
Follow the money. People who know too much, people who ask the wrong questions, people who may have information, or people who do not agree to censor themselves.
Right.
Those are the reasons.
I mean, the deal with Sean Penn with the El Chapo interview allegedly was that El Chapo wanted to see the final edit before Rolling Stone printed the article. Have you ever requested an interview with El Chapo?
Not El Chapo, but I mean, I have talked to people close to other cartel leaders in the past. And my only two concerns are, you know, can they guarantee my protection? Can I do an interview and come back and no strings attached? Hmm. I've never gotten an answer back, or it's been vague. So no, I mean, you know, some people may say, well, you're just jealous that you didn't get the interview. You know, yeah, we all want to get that interview, but not under those conditions.
You know, I think it's safe to say from what I've learned today, even with the recapture of El Chapo, the drugs will continue, the drug war will continue. How will the journalists go on with this deadly slog? Which way forward now, do you think?
I think we just keep plowing away. We keep trying to find truth. We keep trying to shine the light. And we keep hoping that somehow the Mexican government will find a way to protect storytellers, journalists, so that societies or regions that are now living in silence can finally begin to get some valid information, that there is some kind of a journalistic accountability.
Alfredo Corchado is Mexico correspondent for the Dallas Morning News and also now director of the Borderlands Program at the Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University. Alfredo, thank you very much.
Mike, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, how to get more Indian women to open bank accounts. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. In India, banks don't exactly reach out to women. In fact, a recent World Bank study found that fewer than half of all women in India have bank accounts. But a small bank in one remote village may have found a simple way to get more women saving money, having a female employee on staff. From the northern state of Haryana, Sonia Narang has our story.
Shrija Singh Berval crouches in her dirt yard and milks the family cow with her bare hands. Squirts of milk slowly fill a steel pail underneath. It's getting darker, and Shrija needs to finish all her chores because there won't be any light out here after sunset. She pumps water into pots and pans, picks up dried manure patties, and feeds her goats. I'm in the small village of Sorki. It's located off a dirt road 100 miles northwest of India's capital city, Delhi. Shrija grew up far away, thousands of miles from here, in the southern state of Kerala. Back in Kerala, I worked for almost 10 years in a company that made saris and other clothing, she says. But in Haryana, women don't work outside the house. It's different here. I first met Shrija 8 years ago when I was making a documentary film about women from Kerala who came here for arranged marriages. Sex-selective abortion is rampant in Haryana, and that eventually resulted in a shortage of local brides. Shrija says it was very difficult to adjust to a new life in this patriarchal village. Here you have to cover your face, Shrija says. If you don't, men will stare. There you don't have to cover your face. You can go around freely. Here there's no freedom. Women are stuck at home doing housework. The men think backwards. They think badly about women who go outside of their home. In Kerala, most women get an education and hold jobs. Shrija herself studied 2 years past high school, making her one of the most highly educated people in Sorki village. And that's why Shrija does work outside the house. Last year, the local branch of Sarv Haryana Grameen Bank, the only bank in the village, hired her for an administrative job. Shrija's their only female employee. At the bank, Shrija wears a beautiful multicolored scarf, but her face isn't covered like most other women in public. Here, she looks confident and businesslike. She wears a pair of reading glasses. Bank customers gather around her desk, and she carefully fills out their forms in English. It's a language few can read or write here. She also helps customers deposit checks, open accounts, and set up loans. Bank manager Sunil Saini tells me Shrija is attracting a new demographic to this branch, women. They feel much more comfortable talking to her, and that's improved the bank's business.
If we want to include the entire population in the financial realm, we can't keep women separate in any way. It's our responsibility to do everything it takes to bring women into the bank, including employing a woman here. It's for the sake of this country's economy.
Saini says at a recent event, almost half of the customers who signed up for a new bank account were women.
Shrija is motivating other ladies in the village. They see that, even with a little education, Shrija is informing everyone. All the village families come here, and they'll gain awareness just by seeing Shrija at the front desk.
Despite what the manager says, though, Shrija's still classified as a temporary employee, and she only earns $100 a month. She says she's happy she's learning to use a computer, but she wants to be made permanent and make more money. Today, a group of women sits on the dusty pavement outside the bank. They wait their turn to sign up for loans and bank accounts. These ladies are happy to have me open up their accounts and fill out checks, Shrija says. It's going well, and it works out both for them and for me. I take care of their paperwork because most of them are illiterate. I feel happy helping them. Shrija's house is a short walk away. Out in front, kids run around, playing tag in the evening. It's rare to see a girl out in public here, but there is one girl in this group of kids. She's Shrija's 9-year-old daughter, Pooja. I want to give my daughter a good education, Shrija says. I want her to work first, then get married later. Shrija's husband is unemployed right now, so she's supporting the family. Times are tough and school fees are expensive, but Shrija's really determined to send her daughter to a good school. I want my kids to stand on their own 2 feet and make a life for themselves, she says. For the world, I'm Sonia Narang in Sorki Village, India.
Say you just flew into New York from overseas. There's an avocado in your bag. You get busted by the customs agent at JFK Airport, maybe thanks to one of those cute little sniffer dogs, because that foreign fruit is a no-no. So where does all that confiscated food go? Down the drain. Hams and salamis, mangoes and yams. Every day, more than 400 pounds of food ends up in a giant grinder at JFK, never to be seen again. Most people turn over the food without a fuss. Others are not so happy.
I've been threatened by Haiti with voodoo over food. I've taken mangoes from passengers from Jamaica and been threatened with my life. Never a dull moment here at JFK.
That's customs agent Ellie Scaffa. Eben Hall found her. He's a producer with Great Big Story, a new online video network. Hall went to JFK's Terminal 4 and saw passengers coming through customs. He says agents put the confiscated food into rolling yellow bins.
Then they take those and wheel them down a hallway to a sort of unmarked room, which contains probably one of the largest garbage disposals in the world. It's this giant stainless steel table. It's probably about 8 feet long, and it's just piled high with all the illegal food that passengers are bringing in.
Agricultural specialists are looking for diseases and insects that might be hiding in the food. Hall saw all kinds of fruits and vegetables. There were bags of rice and cured meats.
Really, anything and everything. There were these beef candies from China, which I'd never seen before. But all that stuff is prohibited.
Hall says most people are not trying to smuggle in food. They just don't know the rules. And to be fair, the rules can be confusing. The same type of fruit can be okay from one country, but not from another.
And those rules are always kind of changing based on any diseases that might be present in one country or just the rules changing in general. So there are sort of broad guidelines on the Customs and Border Protection website that you can look up, but they actually recommend that you check with the local consulate in the country where you're vacationing or traveling from. And I don't know, I'm sure many people don't have the time to do that. So it can be tricky.
Hall says if you're not sure if your food's legal or not, declare it.
It's not illegal to have the prohibited item, but it is illegal not to declare it. And that's when you get stuck with a fine.
Potentially $300. More likely, though, it'll be a loss of your time while a customs agent rifles through your luggage. To see Hall's video and that massive food grinder, we've got it posted at PRI.org. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Back in the 1970s, David Bowie turned to Japan for fashion inspiration, a style moment and a political moment.
Bowie was really the ultimate diplomat because he healed the rift between the Allies and Japan in the post-war period.
Who knew? Remembering David Bowie's unique fashion sense and music. Ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. He was Ziggy Stardust. He was Space Oddity. Critics and fans thought of David Bowie as not being from planet Earth. But that is Bowie's great legacy. He gave license to a generation, and really everyone since, that it was good to be different. He wanted to be that alien. So songs like this caught on in some unexpected parts of planet Earth. The Bowie classic 5 Years had an effect on young Iranians when it came out. One of them was Mazyar Bahari. He's an Iranian journalist. You may recall his story was portrayed in the 2014 movie Rosewater. Bahari told me how he first became fascinated with Bowie.
I was a teenager in the 1980s in Iran, and as you remember, there was a revolution in Iran in 1979, Islamic Revolution, and a theocratic government came to power, and basically that theocratic government, which is still in power, outlawed any kind of Western music and Western culture. You could be arrested for even owning an audio cassette. I'm sure a lot of your listeners don't remember what audio cassette was, but It was, it's kind of a relic these days that people used to listen to music with at that time. And we were basically really people like me, teenagers who craved for something different, which were tired of our claustrophobic environment. We were looking for things that were different from what was surrounding us. And we could not find anything more different than the mullahs that were ruling Iran at that time than David Bowie. So I never forget.
What was it about David Bowie that made him so different that you thought, this is different from anything else we've seen from outside Iran?
I clearly remember the first song of David Bowie that I listened to was 5 Years, and I did not know the words. I could not speak English at that time. I mean, I could speak a few words of English. And I was just fascinated by this singer who was singing in a way as if his life was dependent on each note, each word. And I became fascinated with him as soon as I listened to 5 Years. And then I got to know David Bowie. I got to listen to some of his other songs. And then I got some books about him, and we were like a group of friends, and my friends and I, we were going through all his albums, and he basically represented kind of an emancipated modern man that we could not find in Iran at that time, or at least that the kind of man that could be sentenced to death in Iran by the conservative clerics that were ruling the country.
What was it about David Bowie, do you think, that would have gotten, the clerics in Iran to say, sentence this man to death?
He was different. He was irreverent. He was a cross-dresser. He kissed other men.
And I gather you almost got into big trouble for being in possession of a David Bowie fanzine where he is photographed kissing Lou Reed.
Exactly. It was a book, I forgot the name of the book. I had it for ages. And when I escaped from Iran in 1987, I took that book with me to Pakistan, where I crossed Iran to Pakistan. And the principal confiscated the book from me. He was looking at this cross-dresser who was kissing other men in the book.
He took it from you at school.
He took it from me at school, and I don't know, somehow, I think I was looking at it during the class, and my teacher sent me to the principal's office, and then the principal started to slap me and insulting me, calling me homosexual, and, a different word used for homosexual that I cannot repeat on the radio. And kept on thinking that he was degrading me, but by telling me that when you grow up, you will be like David Bowie, he was kind of empowering me. And it was amazing because I remember I was humming 5 Years in my head as he was insulting me to be like David Bowie. So I think I was somehow liberated through that experience of thinking about 5 Years and repeating the words that I had just learned, actually.
Maziar Bahari, thanks so much for speaking with us. Really appreciate
it. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Bowie wrote Fashion, but he had a lot more style than just one song could contain. And a lot of his fashion sense can be traced to Japan. In fact, many of the costumes that Bowie wore throughout his career were created by Japanese fashion designer Kansai Yamamoto. Helene Thayen is a fashion historian and a contributor to the anthology Enchanting David Bowie, Space, Time, Body, Memory.
He incorporated the traditional Japanese motifs, colors, designs, as interpreted by the famed Japanese fashion designer Kansai Yamamoto. This includes the hairdo of the era, the buzz-cut-looking, red-fringed fantasy that David Bowie wore, which was actually Kansai Yamamoto's creation and originally inspired by traditional Japanese dolls and kabuki wigs. Furthermore, the makeup, the white face, of course, harkening back to David Bowie's mime training with one Lindsay Kemp in the mid-60s, who actually was the first person to introduce Bowie to Japanese culture, theater, music, and a variety of gestures from the kabuki and the Onagata.
Wow. From mime to kabuki, you just kind of blew my mind there. Now, that thing you just mentioned, Onagata, the Japanese tradition in kabuki where male actors play the women's roles. I mean, considering David Bowie's own androgyny, how did Onagata influence Bowie? Or had he already preceded it with his kind of own form of Onagata?
There was no direct or obvious Onagata interpretation with Bowie in the 60s per se. Bowie at the time was actually a devotee of Buddhism and was going to take his vows to become a Buddhist monk in a monastery in Scotland in Dumfries, and was instrumental in establishing that monastery. And as we know, the pantheon of Buddhist gods includes rather, you could say, androgynous representations. It was all sort of floating about, I believe, in his consciousness, in Bowie's consciousness, which then, in the 70s, with the collaboration with Kansai from 1971, came into full bloom, with Kansai even noting that Bowie's face and body were androgynous and therefore suitable for his own unisex fashion, which he had created. The fact is that in Japanese culture, this androgyny, which so influenced Bowie, was the norm.
What did mainstream Japanese make of a Western man dressing in this androgynous way, acting in this androgynous way?
Loved it. Love, because he really, more than the androgyny, was communicating the relevance, importance, the absolute brilliance and genius of Japanese traditional culture by way of wearing the Kansai Yamamoto outfits, by incorporating the stage techniques from kabuki theater, such as Hayagawari, quick change, where the costumes would simply almost fly off of his body as pulled off by black-clothed assistants, just like in the kabuki. So for them, it was truly an homage. And it's my belief that Bowie was really the ultimate diplomat because he healed the rift between the Allies and Japan in the post-war period, ushering in the postmodern era by incorporating Japanese costuming, staging, makeup, hair, the whole shebang. So he really played a very important role, not just as a rock star showing disaffected youth that they could also exhibit their otherness or alien nature, as Ziggy Stardust was the alien, through wearing all of this extravagant, exotic costuming, makeup, and hair. But that, in a sense, this was a peacemaking attempt.
Helene, whether we in the West know it or not, did David Bowie make us appreciate Japanese culture and fashion?
I absolutely believe that, Marco. Absolutely. And even if it's on an unconscious level, there were a number of rock stars after Bowie that incorporated Japanese clothing, makeup, hair design, such as Suzy Sue and the Banshees, Freddie Mercury traipsing around on a stage with Queen and Kimono, the group Sparks with an album called Kimono My House in 1974. The list goes on and on and on. And so I think that he was the one that ignited this passionate interest in Japan, but also inspired the general public, not just the rock stars in his realm, on a day-to-day level with the interest in wearing the hachimaki around the forehead that we see sushi chefs wear. But, you know, normal kids started showing up with this gear and the T-shirts imprinted with kanji or Japanese characters. So, yes, unequivocally, he ignited that interest.
Fashion historian Helene Thayen there. And you might not be aware of it either, but Bowie had a deep effect on how people in Berlin thought about the Cold War and their role in it, bringing down the Berlin Wall. His song Heroes helped. The fact that Bowie recorded a version in German didn't hurt either.
Niemand gibt uns eine Chance, doch können wir sie dann für immer und immer.
Heroes in German from David Bowie. Let's go back now to a story that we've touched on before. It's about a migrant crisis, but not the one in Europe. This one is taking place on the island of Hispaniola that's made up of Haiti on one side and the Dominican Republic on the other. Last year, the Dominican Republic ordered all immigrants without legal papers to leave the country. That mostly means Haitian migrants. Many Dominicans with Haitian roots fled over the border under threat of deportation or violence. Now, hundreds of migrant families are camped out on the Haitian side of that border. Amy Bracken went to visit one local institution in Anse-à-Pitre that's trying to help.
The Notre-Dame de Lourdes School is a study in contrasts. In the classrooms on one side of the courtyard, children sit in tidy yellow uniforms in rows facing their instructors. On the other side, kids in an assortment of donated clothes push their way in and out of three crowded rooms. One teacher hustles back and forth, trying to maintain some semblance of order. The kids in uniform are locals. Their parents are asked to pay tuition. The rest are Haitian migrants from the DR, and they're too poor to pay. In the past, the school has welcomed a small number of migrant children. But this year, the number ballooned to 216 after hundreds of fleeing families set up makeshift shelters nearby. The students enrolled here are only a fraction of the children in the camps, but they're already too much for the school to handle. That's Brother Alfred Cherfili, the teacher moving between the migrant classes. He says working with the migrant children is very difficult. They don't know how to behave properly, and they're violent. By violent, he means the pushing and shoving, finger-pointing and tears on constant display when Cherfili is not in the room. But Cherfili understands this behavior comes from the children being in very difficult circumstances. Sometimes the parents don't have the means to clean them, to buy clothes for them, he says. They're living in tents, suffering a lot. Some are sick from the dust or kwashiorkor with their swollen bellies. Kwashiorkor is a severe protein deficiency, and many of the migrant children are showing symptoms of it. To top it off, cholera broke out in and around the camps this fall. Cherfili says the school provides lunch and gives some kids soap and clothes, and there's drinking water in the morning, but it runs out too quickly. Most of the new students here have never gone to school before, and they range in age from 4 to 14. Cherfili is going through basic math assignments with some of the older kids, trying to determine their proficiency. Then he switches classrooms and teaches younger ones vowels and left from right. By 11 o'clock, classes are over for the migrant students, and they line up for a plate of rice and beans, for many their only meal of the day. Then a bus brings them up the road to their shelters. The Notre Dame School is among the few local institutions here that are helping the migrants. There isn't much else this town of 9,000 can do. It has no electrical grid, no gas station, and just a few tiny businesses. Locals toil in the lowest level jobs, like harvesting charcoal and importing used clothes. But the mayor, Michel-Ange Morlon, says he's proud of the town's response to the newcomers. He says, I think this is the best population in the world. Why? Because in spite of all the problems the people of Anse-à-Pitre have, they have never turned away a single immigrant. I congratulate them a lot for that. There's been criticism of the national government for not doing enough. The government says it's provided funds for migrants to relocate to their home villages in Haiti, but it's reluctant to build latrines and other structures that might make the camps permanent. Notre Dame's principal thinks his new students aren't going anywhere soon. He's hoping for international aid to help hire teachers and provide books, drinking water, and food. And eventually, he wants to see the migrant kids sitting in uniforms alongside their local classmates. For The World, Amy Bracken, Anse-à-Pitre, Haiti.
Coming up, the bass player who helped make David Bowie's Space Oddity a classic, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. In this age when seemingly everything you write is saved somewhere electronically, it's intriguing to hear about the days of paper and ink, you know, like a real letter. And this story is about a letter with a pretty incredible history. 73 years ago, Dutchman Peter Will was seized by the Nazis. Will was a member of the Dutch resistance. Before he boarded a train to a German concentration camp, Will penned a letter to his wife and six sons. That letter has finally gotten to Peter Will's son, Joop. My BBC colleague, Anna Holligan, has a story.
This is the letter.
It's so delicate.
This was a big surprise. He writes this letter to his dearest wife and children.
The reason the Nazis targeted your father was because he resisted them.
Yeah.
After all the centuries, within the lifetime of most of us, the sky became an arena. Over the world, over Europe, over England.
Joop's father was working as a meat inspector underneath one of the key crossing points for Allied forces during the war.
If a plane comes down, it was mostly there in that area.
Your father helped to save about 900 British pilots.
Helped to save.
He remembers during one Liberation Anniversary parade meeting a man who recognised a photo of his father.
That man, I know him. I have been in his house, and under the floor of his living room was place there I have been hidden. We hear the feet of the children, and I said, yes, that's for mine.
And it's not just anecdotes. There is hard evidence of the role that Peter Will played in hiding the Western Allies. So you have a certificate signed by Eisenhower, yeah, to your father, expressing, it says, the gratitude and appreciation of the American people for the gallant service in assisting the escape of Allied soldiers from the enemy.
Yeah.
And that's what the Nazis didn't like, because he was helping the opposition.
They never know that. They have arrested him because he makes little papers, informations about the war.
That were little things that liberate our country. Yes, I'm proud about my grandfather. That he gave his life, it's very sad.
Joop's daughter Hetty went to collect her grandfather's belongings from the International Tracing Service in Germany. She now wants other families to know about the 30 million documents in the ITS archive, so that they too may discover the lost pieces of their history.
Incredible story. The BBC's Anna Holligan reporting there. We were talking earlier on the show about David Bowie and what kind of impact he had globally in places like Iran. We also heard how Japan influenced his incredible sense of fashion. We haven't really spoken yet about Bowie's music, so let's do that now, and I'm going to call in Herbie Flowers for this. In the late 60s, Flowers was a young jazz bass player. He was slowly making a name for himself on the London music scene, and he got a call to play on a new record by an unknown singer-songwriter. One of the songs they tracked was about a lonely astronaut taking his first flight into space. That great middle bit there from David Bowie's Space Oddity. You can hear that Herbie Flowers bass line walk down there. Herbie Flowers went on to tour with David Bowie, and he joins us now. Herbie Flowers, our condolences to you on the loss of your former collaborator. Tell us, before you went out on tour with him, what were your very first impressions of meeting David Bowie on that Space Oddity session?
The record company, Philips, thought that Space Oddity might be a hit. And I rolled up in the studio, and there was just David, myself, Terry Cox, who was a drummer, and David sang us the song, and we laid the track. It was unusual, but it was fantastic, and it was very clear that David knew exactly what he wanted. I slipped and slid about, it seemed to work, and that was the beginning of a very long, happy association that I had with David. which included an awfully long tour of the United States.
Awfully long tour.
Well, we'll awfully, get to that. Now, the English do say awfully means very. It doesn't mean that. It got a bit hairy in places because we were dressed up, okay? And for the male in the early 70s to be going around with slap on their face wasn't really very good. The further south
you mean,
we went.
Makeup.
Yeah.
Anyway, you went to the southern United States. And they
yeah,
didn't really
and it was just scary. I don't think people, a lot of the audience, were a bit uncomfortable. And David was very theatrical.
I've always been a big fan of David Bowie's music, but, you know, it was not until I heard Brazilian musician Seu Jorge translate Bowie's songs into Portuguese and kind of gave them a bossa nova spin that I realized what a talented composer Bowie was. It wasn't just glam rock. How did he change your own approach to music and thinking about music?
The complete master. Every phase of David's career, to me, was like a picture. The pictures of him with that streak of lightning across his face, and another picture of him in a light blue suit, and another one of him with red hair and massive eye makeup, are all fantastic pictures. He's the greatest person I've ever worked for, and I love him. I just thank you, David.
I was speaking with bassist Herbie Flowers, who collaborated for years with David Bowie. We've spun a lot of Bowie tracks today, but let's close with the next generation of Bowie disciples. I broke out my copy of Seu Jorge's Life Aquatic Sessions. It's from the Wes Anderson film The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, where Seu Jorge does his wonderful Bowie covers in Portuguese. So here's Changes for you. And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow. Vou pro mundo porque nada mais me prende aqui. É o final do show. E não fique magoado porque vou partir. É só o jeito que eu sou. Changes, lá vem meu trem. Vem meu trem. Tô saindo fora porque vou me dar bem. Changes, lá vem meu trem, vem meu trem. Sei que tá na hora e eu vou me dar bem. Sempre em frente, nunca pra trás. Não é por nada não, mas vou medir. PRI, Public Radio International.